pop idol. The fans are all waiting. So I decided I'm going to sing with Rei and Yukiko again. No, I'm not. I'm an actress now. Don't be stupid. No one really wants that.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus review of Perfect Blue.
I thought you decided to go through with this. Everyone is out here waiting for you.
A patron-exclusive review chosen by Robert Redden.
Thank you very much. You're the only one I can depend on.
Hosted by Arnie.
No, I'm the real thing.
Stuart.
You watch too many TV shows.
And Jacob.
Hey, I'm not so bad at this.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Where did this come from? How do they know so much?
We hope you enjoy the show.
I mean, today I just wanted us to please have a good time.
Today we're discussing Perfect Blue, starring Junko Iweo, Rika Matsumoto, Shiho Niyama, directed by Satoshi Kon. This is the Now Playing co-host who'd rather wear jeans than tight business suits. You know what? New year, I'm not going to exert myself. I'm going to dress casually. Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is your angel of love smiling at you, Jacob. I love those lyrics that you recited, Arnie. Like, that is probably one of the greatest songs. Like, I'm just going to be casual. I'm not dressing up no more. What a pop song.
But they're wearing, like, these tight, form-fitting, kick-ass dresses while they're singing it. It's so hypocritical.
You know those pop stars.
Hello, January patrons. We thank you for joining us on another year of patron picks. And yes, we're already jumping into a movie that, yeah, at this point is, what, about 25 years old, a little bit more than, Perfect Blue.
Yes, this was picked by a longtime friend of mine, guy who I met through Star Wars Action News, and I've known him about 20 years now. He's a good friend, Robert Redden, and for his birthday to himself this last year, he got himself a Now Playing review. And wanted us to review Perfect Blue. He saw this before it was even released in the States. He was into Robotech fanzines and saw reviews that were just praising this movie. And so he ended up with an unrated dubbed version that he thought might have a little bit of flair from anime. And he said it was a breathtaking film that surpassed his expectations on every level. He's seen all of Satoshi Kon's other works and thinks they're just the highest quality anime and uses the medium to blend reality and fantasy in a way he doesn't think live action could match. And he just really wanted to see us discuss that film and also spread some awareness of that film to people who may not know. And I didn't know. I'd never heard of this movie until he recommended it. And I heard anime. I figured there'd be tentacle monsters.
Yeah, this is one I've seen before, but I came upon it because I saw one of Kon's other films, Paprika, which is, I'm guessing all of his films are real mind trips, but that one, it's about dream terrorists going into dreams and you get some real surreal imagery. And I'm like, it's just crazy. And I'm like, what else has this guy done? And I stumbled upon this one. This was his first film. I'm like, yeah, I'll give this one a watch.
Yeah, I did see this movie as well. I saw it. It got a small American theatrical release. And I lived in a major city at that time, Chicago. I think it came to the Music Box and had a 1 week run. And I was really, it was a time in my life where I was consuming a lot of anime. So Ghost in the Shell, Steam Boy, Cowboy Bebop, you name it, whatever I could get my hands on, I was seeing it. It did have a lot of hype to it. What I remember the press saying is, this is an anime unlike other anime, that you would be surprised at how sophisticated it was, and it name-dropped people like Alfred Hitchcock, David Lynch, and that we should really expect a different kind of experience. Certainly no tentacle monsters, Arnie. And it might have gotten a little bit oversold. I remember seeing it. I remember liking it. But it didn't leave a lasting impression on me. I have not seen it since. And had frankly forgotten about it until it came across our radar.
Did you read the book? I know you often read books, Stuart, and I saw this was based on a book. I was curious how tightly coupled this was to the prose.
Yes, I did read it, and no, it's nothing at all like what we're here to talk about. In 1991, we had an author, Yoshikazu Takeuchi, who wrote something called Complete Metamorphosis. And maybe it's just coincidence, but it was basically about a serial killer who was making a woman suit and wanted to take it off pop stars and then put it on so that he could be their moral compass. It was a little bit Silence of the Lambs, Buffalo Bill, for my taste, same year as that film. It was mostly just about a sick fanboy. And while the names of the characters in this movie are the same from the book, they basically kept that part of it. There is a Japanese pop star. She's not trying to become an actress. She's just trying to be relevant. 3 years into her career, she's going to do a nudie book. And it was a big deal that she was going to pose for, you know, racy pictures. But, you know, I think we see this in our own culture. Even if you're not familiar with Japanese pop culture, I think that, you know, if you look at the Disney and Nickelodeon pipeline, all those people that became stars by doing children's entertainment, there's always that pressure to suddenly show that you're an adult, that you're not the puppet of Mickey Mouse, that you have your own identity and that you are sexy, sophisticated, and, you know, daring. And I think that, yes, it was the hope of the filmmakers that they could expand on the ideas of the book and really, you know, make a very meta, I think, commentary about anime itself.
I know we had pop stars like Madonna and she had her sex book, but that was already kind of her image. I feel like...
No, Madonna was never a virgin. She was like a virgin, which meant that she had been fucking since the minute we saw her.
Which is what I'm saying. It wouldn't be until the late 90s where you get a Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, and then we go on to Miley Cyrus, Selena Gomez. Like, so I think this is coming out like right as those original pop stars coming from Disney are emerging.
Yeah. The author of the original book just identified as a fan, that it is very common for adult men to be really into pop star girls and that you pick your favorites, kind of like maybe Pokemon or baseball teams. You just get behind one and you want to see how far it can go. And I think that he wanted to write about extreme fandom. And the end of the actual book, it's nothing like this at all. The guy ends up skinning himself and walking around like Hellraiser, bleeding all over the place. He had skinned a rival girl group, and now he was trying to get Mima as well and does not succeed.
The book sounds more like Double Blind, the TV show in this movie.
Yeah, it just sounds more like a serial killer movie you'd get in the 1990s. I mean, I felt like we got a lot of those psycho fan kind of, you know, we know the drill, right? They get obsessive.
Yeah, they even make a joke about that in the movie.
Yeah, you know, I don't want you to change your image. A lot of it was about the idea of transformation, right? That metamorphosis is in the title. You're going from being a girl to a woman. I want to, you know, and this is where I think pop culture theorists like to talk about. And do we infantilize? Do we want women to stay girls? Can we accept that they sexually develop? I mean, I think that he had his own reckoning with that. And that was part of what inspired him to write the book. Again, I also think he might have just seen Silence of the Lambs and wanted to do a take on Buffalo Bill in the woman suit. But they didn't read the book. The filmmaker, he had no involvement with the book. He asked the author if he could just take the concept. He read the script that had been written based on the book and said, I want to take this and do more with it. And I always like that as an adaptation. I know some people want, sometimes when you love a book, you just want to see it done, you know, in a faithful way up on screen, no changes. But I always like The Shining, you know, like I'm going to take what you got going and I'm going to push it into a new territory, maybe even explore things you weren't thinking about and make it my own. I mean, I always appreciate when filmmakers do that. It's not a straight, faithful adaptation. It's taking what frankly felt like a half-baked idea, and really expanding upon it, making it meta.
Yeah, that sounds very different. And I was wondering, because I just did a little bit of digging into this and saw that this director, he was a first-time director working on this, and that he kind of wanted to tell his own story and established some kind of guidelines with the author of that book of things that would stay the same between the book and the movie so that there was some kind of resemblance, but it seemed very loose. And so I wasn't sure, because I ended up watching this movie twice for this review, because it is trippy and surrealistic. And at times, this is the first time I watched it, I walked away like, okay, so was that real or was that in her mind? And
I still got those questions.
Yeah, I don't think that that can be definitively answered. In fact, the bonus material on this disc, the director was bragging about the fact that it was the game that they were hoping to play, is how often they could confuse people. He's actually a little disappointed that the movie is as literal as it is, that you can't actually figure out a murder plot, that I think it was the original intent to make something far more abstract and out there. But yes, that was my impression, was that it really, the way that he talked about it is that it's not that there's even one scene in the movie. It's like a continual evolving montage. Again, think about metamorphosis. We don't know what we're watching, and it's always changing in front of us. It goes from inner states to outer states. Highly influential. I know that if you look out on the internet for this movie, there are a lot of people out there that have done deep cuts where they try to compare it to other movies out there. Black Swan. I see that many people have called that movie out as a ripoff, or at least taking great cinematic inspiration from this movie. There's several shots and themes.
Aronofsky said Black Swan was not based on this because he's heard those comparisons, but he said Requiem for a Dream very much was, and he took specific shots in Requiem for a Dream straight out of this movie as intentional homage.
Yeah, I do think he was a fan. Khan died very early at 46 because of cancer, and Aronofsky wrote a eulogy for him, so he must have been some kind of fan.
Yeah, but I want to give credit where credit is due. Yes, I'm sure when we talk about this, we can talk about the influence of David Lynch, we can talk about the influence of Alfred Hitchcock, but truly, it's Ingmar Bergman that deserves the most credit. He made a movie called Persona, and it was about an actress who had become paralyzed and was being taken care of by a nurse, and their identities over time, over the caregiving, flip. And he is a director who loves to, I always say he's our psychological horror movie maker. All of his films, they're art films. They're not horror specific, they're kind of horror adjacent, but they try to take nightmare states, the way people feel internally, and create psychodrama. He tries to externalize inner anxieties. And so that movie, it's a whole lot of artsy stuff. But I do think that in many ways, Perfect Blue and a lot of movies play with the same ideas, are inspired by the idea that a female pop star's identity, an actress, could get lost in a world of trying to decide who she was from the roles she's asked to play in her life. It starts with Persona.
So that's another movie for people to check out. I have not seen Persona, but it sounds like a lot like this movie from what you describe. And show my hand. I enjoyed this movie and would like to see more tales like it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do. I mean, I think that, again, just a few years after this, David Lynch did this with Mulholland Drive. I mean, I definitely feel like whether people were directly copying, it was in the air. I do think that in the late 90s, we were becoming more meta. We were questioning our entertainment. We were looking at media. And, you know, that's another trippy, surreal story about women's identities flipping in Hollywood. I have seen Paprika. I haven't seen the other two. He made four films.
Tokyo Godfathers. I've not seen his other ones, but I know, like, he had a short career, but all of his stuff was, like, very influential.
And they all seem to have the same kind of theme about how much we can discern dream state from reality, you know, fantasy, our imagined lives, our inner states, and our exterior reality are often a blurred subjective experience. I think he's big on that. And this movie definitely is big on that. Let's get into it. Arnie, you got the plot?
A young woman, Mima, leaves her pop group Cham to pursue acting, landing a minor role on the hit TV show Double Bind. This decision creates tension between her agents. Rumi, a former pop idol herself, opposes the move, while Takadoro supports it for the financial potential. Mima faces challenges. Angry fans, a struggling acting career, and Cham thriving without her. Meanwhile, an obsessive fan, Mimania, stalks her and runs a website called Mima's Room, where he impersonates her online. Her growing stress deepens when she films a controversial rape scene and poses nude, decisions fueled by Takadoro and against Rumi's advice. As Mima's mental health deteriorates, murders occur on the Double Bind set, making her question her own sanity. The real killer, Mimania, attacks Mima, but she defends herself and escapes. However, Rumi's split personality is revealed. She believes she is the real Mima and tries to eliminate her. After a chase through the city, Rumi is injured and wanders into the street, and Mima saves Rumi from an oncoming bus. Sometime later, Mima is now a successful actress, visiting Rumi in a mental institution, as credits roll. And as they start, I'm really confused. I'm watching Power Rangers? What's going on here? I had no idea what I was in for. I mean, I knew nothing about Perfect Blue, except a couple of things that Robert had told me and said that it would be very adult themed. And now I'm starting off with a Power Rangers ripoff. I'm like, whoa.
Stuart talked about how things were getting meta, and I definitely feel like that's going on here. The fact that kids are going to call this out as cheap, that's how I felt when I saw Power Rangers as like an 18-year-old. I'm like, who would ever watch this? That's going to crash. And then it became a huge worldwide phenomenon. But yeah, this is a great joke at the beginning.
Yeah, you think you are seeing one thing, and it ends up being something else, is the theme of the movie, right? We're not sure what we're looking at. Who are you is an existential question that the anime genre itself could be asking. If you say Japanimation, I think that would have been the word I would have used in the late 90s. This is what you would have thought of. You know, it was this kind of, yeah, big tentacled bad guy against five people in multicolored spandex. Powertron is, I think, what they're calling them. But yes, it ends up just being a stage show opener for a J-pop band, which makes me want to see more J-pop bands if your openers are like, yeah, Kitty Morphin time. And yes, we see kids walking away from that kind of, you know, I called them Stuart and Arnie, you know, running away from the theater, complaining it was so cheap. It was way too expensive of a ticket. It just sounds like, you know, us complaining as children about the entertainment we were served. And then out among in the crowd, we see the bootleggers. We see that it's not just little kids that are going to see this. There are adult men, and they're really into all of this. They have a lot invested in Cham, the J-pop band. If you want a rare bootleg of Rhea covering for Mima on some chorus of something. I mean, you know how obsessive fans can be. I mean, I know this world. I may not know J-pop, but I definitely know people that, yes, thrive on being able to find the rare recording, the unusual thing, to know everything they can, document everything that is known about a band.
And this movie keeps me off my guard during these early scenes because we follow some of these fans. They're talking about how tickets are too expensive. They're talking about how cheap the show is. I think we're seeing our main characters here. And we see some guy with weird eyes. I'm later going to learn his name is Mimania or Mimania. But he has really weirdly drawn eyes is what I noticed most about him. It stood out. It was almost like he had empty eye sockets. And then there's a rival gang of nerds who are going to start throwing cans and things. And I just think these guys are our main characters. And so I start trying to, in my notes, keep track of who's who and what they're spending their money on. And then the J-pop group comes out and I'm like, these people aren't going to matter. Let's just get through the song. I had no idea. This is why I had to watch it a second time. I didn't realize we were being introduced to the main character in the song.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and then the way it's going to edit that, this is about a J-pop band, cut to a subway, then cut to an opening title. Like, it is really hard to get your orientation at the beginning of this film right away.
Or throughout the whole movie. Again, by design.
That's what I'm saying. It starts at the very beginning, and it will never let you figure it out.
There is no scene. There's no moment that holds together as just an unbroken moment. every image, everything we experience is a reflection, a refraction of some other point in time. And I think once you soak in the movie, maybe a second watch, what you realize you're experiencing is the glamorous glitz of stepping out on stage for this pop star. And then the reality is I do my own grocery shopping. I bike. I don't get limos everywhere. And then I go home to a one-room efficiency that's pretty dirty. And I've got a poster up on the wall of my band, hoping they'll be big. They're big enough that there are people out there. I have fans, psycho fans at that, but they haven't even been on the charts yet. And I do feel like, yes, it sets up a culture in which is not unlike today's YouTube, TikTok, everyone can be a celebrity kind of culture, right? When we're all realizing we can get the likes, the hits, we can have those numbers.
And again, this is keeping me off guard because on the one hand, people seem really upset that Mima is leaving Cham. And I'm thinking, well, they must be a big band. She has that poster up. But then why are they playing such a shitty small stadium if they're such a big band?
This is worse than a state fair.
And later on, we're going to find out they never even cracked the top 100. I'm like, oh, so they really aren't that big of a deal. She has some local fans, but it's not like she is a Britney Spears or something, which is what I was first relating her to. And really, the parallel I saw a lot of in this after the reveal is Selena. Also, you know, with the assistant and things. So this is no Selena. This is like a local hit, I guess, that is about to take off. And she's only been with the band for 2.5 years. I guess she moved to Tokyo to be a pop star and got hooked up with the group there, Cham. But now when this movie starts, she's ready to move on from that. 2.5 years of singing is enough. Like every musical artist who makes it big, they want to really act and prove they can by hosting SNL, it seems, because that's where all the singers seem to start and end up sucking, like Ariana Grande.
America wasn't always on this train. I feel like Japan, you were always expected to work in all media. But in America, we used to have very clear delineations between a TV actor, a movie actor, and a musician. It was really weird when one tried to move into another field. And it would be quite a feat if they actually succeeded in doing so.
Oh, the 80s. I mean, I can't decide when we laughed harder, when Bruce Willis was singing or when Madonna was acting. I mean, Don Johnson had Heartbeat, but there was also another album around that song. You know, every time somebody stepped out of their comfort zone, I feel like the public was there with forks and knives ready to dig into them for doing something different. Eddie Murphy, yeah, he had Party All the Time, but he also had Put Your Mouth on Me. We were just ready to say, do what you do, don't try something different.
Yeah, America, that isn't what a pop idol is. But in Japan, I really do think that, you know, you have characters that hawk everything from, you know, condoms to snow cones. You put your stamp on everything and it becomes a lifestyle. And so you become this mass marketed concept. And I think that 2.5 years, to me, that sounds like no time at all. That is the lifespan of somebody trying to make it in this industry, right? If you don't evolve, if you don't change, you know, you're not going to be around. You don't have a career that lasts decades. It's not particularly clear why she feels the need to move on from Cham, other than they're a trio and maybe she just wants to be in the spotlight by herself.
Yeah, if they haven't broken the top 100 yet, why not try something else?
It is strange just that we never find out what is pushing her to be an actress. Is it something that she wants to do? Is it something that that manager Tokumoto is doing? I mean, he says she's not making enough money in Cham. And once we find out they don't even have a top 100 hit, that's probably why they're not making enough money. But she doesn't seem to have the calling for acting. She says many times when she starts acting that it's difficult, but it's a challenge she wants to take. I feel like she just wants to grow up. Like all those Disney kids you were mentioning, Stuart, at a certain point, half of them pose nude just to say, look, I'm an adult now.
Yeah, it's a reaction. And I think the moment, the most telling moment about who she is there's a, within this montage of jumping around from her life on stage wearing the baby doll dress and doing the choreography to her, you know, living very modestly in this tiny apartment. When she is there talking about her future direction, she's silent. She's like huddled on a chair, and it's her handlers. It is Rima and the manager and all the other people reviewing the tapes and talking about what she should do. She doesn't have a voice in her own life, in her own career. She does what's expected of her.
Yeah, there's one line, I think it's from Rumi, that says, what about her feelings as they're having all this discussion? Those are never taken into consideration. It's about how to remold this thing to make us money.
Yeah, she never speaks up. And again, I think in so many ways, why this becomes this psychological nightmare for her, this career path that she takes to be an actress, is that she's being pushed further and further outside of her comfort zone. She's saying yes to things that she is internally not cool with. And being inauthentic, yeah, I will fuck you up.
And I can see maybe why she wants to try something else. This concert does not go great. There's like these hoodlums there throwing trash. A fight's gonna break out. It's just total chaos. Like, I was in a punk band, that's expected, but not when you're in a J-pop girl band.
Yeah. Well, again, they step on her announcement. Some of the fans are already whispering this is her last concert, but Mima is going up to the mic. And all of a sudden, yeah, these guys that clearly don't have any respect for her or Cham or anything just start causing problems. And this is where we get introduced to the idea of the stalker. This is guy in the front row who has like been holding up his fingers and just like keeping Mima in his view. He cuts the other two out. He doesn't even pay attention to the other members of Cham. For him, it's a one-on-one relationship. He is there to be with Mima. So when these guys are being rude, he goes over there and just, you know, acts scary. They try to punch him. They try to, you know, get him to back down. And he doesn't make a sound when he's punched, when his nose is bloody. So we know that this is the crazy stalker. I think hopefully by this point, Arnie, you've gotten a sense that this is the dynamic, that this is about a crazy man that loves his pop idol.
Yeah, I got oriented pretty quickly. This movie's very short. So yeah, when we see her shopping and we're following her and meeting her with the managers, I'm like, okay, so this is her story we're going to be following. And we get this wonderful, very dated. It's like the only part of the movie that doesn't work is when she gets a fan letter and is like, what is a web page? They're networked computers. What are networked computers? And trying to learn about the stalker through the World Wide Web when that wasn't a thing.
Yeah, this is like when you had Friends teach you, you know, that TV show. Rachel and Ross are going to teach you how to get on the internet. And, like, there's going to be whole scenes of just instructions. Because, I don't know, it's 97. Like, I know, Arnie, you're a techie guy. But a lot of people are just getting on the internet for the first time in 97. So, when you think about when this came out, it makes sense. You got to explain what a web browser is.
I had never been on the internet until 1997. That is true. Yeah. So, this doesn't feel odd to me. It was something I'd heard about. It had been on the cover of Time magazine a few years before, but I hadn't gone on the web yet. And so, yes, she's a 21-year-old woman who is still putting on baby doll dresses and singing girly, cutesy songs, who is now learning really what people, again, for a lot of us, this happened. Suddenly the web opens up and we're inviting a lot of people that we know and don't know their feedback about our lives. What do people think of me? I mean, what gets said to her as she's going to the limo is, I'm always looking at Mima's room. Now, is that a threat? I'm a stalker hanging outside your room? Or is that just, I log on and go to your fan page, which is run by that weird guy in the front row, because it's called Mima's room. And it pretends to know all the intimate details of her daily life because, yeah, it does look like this guy is following her around, taking pictures of her buying milk at the grocery store, and maybe even peeking through her curtains and capturing moments from her very private life.
Yeah, I really like that scene when she just kind of looks out the window and wonders, is there someone out there watching me?
That's what I thought. I didn't think it was going to be a website. I thought somebody, you're in a big city with a lot of tall buildings. She's a famous person who keeps her curtains open. All it takes is a pair of binoculars and you have all the information you need. But no, it's somebody who is stalking her and paying attention to what brand of milk she buys and
what foot she uses to get off the subway.
This is an obsessive stalker fan who, yeah, what's funny is at no point, and I guess it's because it's the early days of the internet, but there's never any, this isn't me from Mima about this. She reads it and it's like, yeah, I do these things, and is kind of amused that somebody's writing all of it.
We were all amused with the internet in 97. We didn't understand its danger.
Yeah, I think she's a little bit tickled. Somebody noticed me. I've been witnessed is flattery. I mean, again, for someone that wants to get famous, to know, to have that direct connection to fans, suddenly, yeah. I think initially she experiences it as a joy of connection, and then very quickly she's like, why do they know all this about me? And, you know, I think one of the arguments you can make is anybody can do this because her entire life was so controlled, right? Everything that she did, she followed a script. There is a boilerplate how to be a pop star, and she's plugged into that machine. So on some level, it's not any different from her than anybody else. She is just living the life in which, yeah, she's exploited by the system. But it's starting to feel creepy, whereas initially it was what she wanted. And it starts the existential questioning. It's her first line in the show. She's been cast in a small part. I think it's telling. We see a billboard for the show, and the TV star is the giant face on the poster. Her face is a little box at the bottom of that poster. And that's just one poster in a sea of posters on the skyline of Tokyo. But yeah, when she has to give her line, who are you? It really is the movie's question.
And it's so easy to ignore the Rumi character who's always around. And there's a line dropped about how she used to be a pop idol herself. This is all stuff that will prove to be very important later on. But it seems like Mima isn't paying a lot of attention to Rumi. She's just like, here, hold my coat. I have to go say my line now. And Rumi is always, it's kind of like the two angel and devil on your shoulder is her two managers, with Rumi as the angel being like, oh no, you need to keep your clothes on and be a pop star and be a good girl. And then Tokumoto is the devil on the shoulder, like, let's go for the money. Let's take the clothes off. Let's do all these things. But neither one feels like they're going to be as important as Rumi will become.
Yeah. If you read the source novel, you're even more thrown off, because Rumi was the assistant, but she was a victim. She was a victim of the stalker, and she gets kidnapped in the finale. I believe she lives, but you are not ever looking at her as potentially a suspect. And if this were a straight adaptation, she would just be someone to be skinned. And Iri Okaye, the TV star, was actually a rival pop star who was calculating on how to bring this girl down. And so it was much more catty, much more showgirls. You know, you get the sense that pop stars are very insecure around each other, and they're rooting for each other's failure. That this other star was trying to find photographs of this pop star with, it's a lot about image, that she had dated this one guy in a more rough and tumble band, and if those photos came out, it would ruin her career. Honestly, that feels a little maybe too specific to Japanese culture. I don't know that it would be that shocking to find out that, you know, Britney Spears dated Axl Rose, right?
No, probably not. I mean, unless it was during Britney Spears' I'm a Virgin period of her life. But here, the thing about Mima is she's a very solitary person. I don't even get a whole lot of sense about family. There's going to be one scene where she's preparing a bath and her mother calls her and she's like, Mom, I'm taking a bath. Call me back later. And later on, she's like, my mother's going to be so shocked. Isn't it funny that I'm going to be doing a rape scene in this TV show? But she doesn't seem to have anybody to connect to. She doesn't have a boyfriend. She doesn't have a best friend. She doesn't talk to her mother. She moved away from home to go be in Cham. And so everything has to be internalized in her because there's nobody for her to talk to or confide in.
She's got her fish.
Yes, those symbolic fish. Yeah, I definitely think that's why she relates to them, right? That she's just this pretty thing in a tank. I think that's very true. I mean, from what I understand about all, you know, teen idol bands, you know, whether they be Korean, Japanese, American, is that you are the product that a manager has put together. And so you're always hustling. You got to get up in the morning, work out, and then you got to do the choreography. Then you got to go to the photo shoot, and your days are planned for you. And there's very little room for you to exhibit any kind of personal taste or feeling. And so, yes, she's not even that far up on the chain where she's that big. She lives like any other person. You know, she, again, that the modesty of her living environment, the fact that she goes to the grocery store and buys just a few things, this is not how we envision celebrities living. She is away from her family. She is away. She had to do all, she had to make those choices in order to get as far as she has. And she's still nowhere near where she imagines she wants to be.
And we saw something a little scary earlier on when she was home alone. She got that fax because it's 1997 and people have fax machines saying that she's a traitor over and over. Mm-hmm. And that's going to literally blow up at this TV shoot. It feels like every time she has to say a line, something will happen to interrupt her. Like, we'll always get some event or some cut whenever she goes to say one of her lines for the show. She gets a piece of fan mail, and when her manager opens it, it explodes.
Yeah, which was the thing. I remember this happened to Bjork, was that they mailed her an acid bomb. She was dating a black man at the time, and there was somebody that thought that she was being impure. Again, people have judgments. When you're their idol, when you use that word, you're really saying that we have expectations.
Yeah, it's like an unfaithful partner. Like, I think some of these people feel like they're married to them.
Yeah, yeah. You owe it to us to be this. You represent this to us. We will not let you change from that. Which, again, I have some empathy for stars that get tired of playing the same role. I mean, you can imagine anybody wanting to do something different. Cham, yeah, 2.5 years, that was probably about enough. I think I would be really done by this point.
When she's talking to her mom, she says that being this pop idol is suffocating me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's this way very much in American real life. I think Twitter has exposed just how insane fans really are. I mean, look at all the butthurt people about The Last Jedi who feel like they own Star Wars and what did you do to my Star Wars and things like that. It's not just pop stars, it's properties as well. And yeah, you can get obsessive and you can get into those dark places. And that's what's happening to Mimania here, as we do get some glimpses into his goon cave where he's making that web page for Mima's room.
Now, here's something I'll throw out there. You can definitely interpret this as a typical stalker scenario of the fan that, like, this guy mailed her that letter bomb, right? That's one way of looking at it. But it could be disconnected. She's told later when the screenwriter gets killed, you know, like, she's wondering, is that connected? And I do think it's, you know, when you live in this world, it could be several different people. In her mind, she has made it this greasy stalker guy. But that may just be her subjective experience. It may be that that guy's not any more real than the Cham phantom that's going to start following her around.
And I thought Mimania was way too obvious to be the killer here. When things were happening and she has, I don't know if they're visions of Mimania or if Mimania actually has gotten into the set and is there while she's filming and things. She's seeing him, but I don't know if that was real. But he's just such a creepy guy from the moment we're introduced to him in that very first pop scene where he's like putting his hand out and sees Mima literally in his hand in that perspective. I'm like, he's the red herring. He's not going to be the killer. Well, he is the killer, but he's being motivated by something else.
Yeah, he's being manipulated to do all this. He's being fed what to print on that webpage.
Right. Maybe. That's the most literal interpretation of the images we're being seen. But again, I will offer that almost everything could just be paranoia. Could just be that, yes, she saw this fan once in the front row and he went and beat up somebody. And then she gets on an elevator and that guy has taped up on there a hit and run of the fan that caused the ruckus, right? It's implying that that guy went and ran down the jerk that was disrupting the concert. And so that puts in her mind the idea that this is the one that's taunting me, that's chasing me. But it may or may not be.
Yeah, I definitely think until you get to the end, depending on how literal you take that when I'm watching it the second time, because I know the plot, I'm really trying to pay attention to these things to find where the ambiguities are. And I think a lot of times, yeah, Mimania, maybe he's there, maybe he's not. She'll look in the crowd and see him 1 second, and then he's gone the next. Did he just like slip out when she blinked? Who knows? But there's definitely that play you could have there with does he exist or not?
Yeah, I mean, he exists, if nothing else, in her mind as something to be worried about, that there are people out there that want to hurt me, that some of these quote-unquote fans have sending me letter bombs, that have malice in my heart. And thank God my manager opened that letter and not me.
And the manager is a good manager because she wants to be an actress. He's working on that writer before the writer gets attacked to get her a bigger part on the show. And we're going to get this quick aside. Again, this movie's very short, but it's so rich with details that I got so much on the second viewing. But the writer doesn't know who the killer is on the show. I feel like that's Ryan Murphy during the third season of Nip Tuck.
Or David Lynch in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
So many shows. Lost, yeah, all of those.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we going?
So the writer needs a way out and realizes that, oh, Mima's not going to be a pop star anymore, then maybe we can arrange for her to be our killer, but we've got to traumatize the character. We've got to have this brutal rape scene, which means Japanese television is a lot different than American television.
And it is. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, it is.
Yes. Which is what I find so enchanting, and I think what many people find enchanting in Western cultures about Japanese culture is the way that it can mix the naive and the really cute with the dark and the sinister in such shocking ways that, like, you just wouldn't think that this would be permissible, that people would want to see a cute pop star violated in this way is just, you know, mind-blowing. Right? You know, usually you want to protect things that are precious and cute. And in so much of Japanese culture, I feel like it dares to defile. It's certainly going to be her journey in that, yes, if she wants a bigger role than saying one line, who am I? She's going to have to do what actresses are expected to do. Again, this is, I think, a wry commentary of like, this is the kinds of parts that women get. If you want to be an actress, you have to be a rape victim. You have to be a slutty girl that gets, you know, I think what we see from the bits that are filmed, she was approached on the street about being a model. And then during the photo shoot, she's encouraged to walk down the gangplank and, you know, swing on the pole. And before you know it, yes, she's in over her head. The grabby guys have turned it into sexually assaulting.
Yeah, I'm not trying too hard to follow what's happening on the TV show because, you know, there's quite a lot with that. I wasn't sure if the guy who approached her to be a model was really in the TV show or if that was real life. I mean, there's definitely some blurring.
I think that's part of the mystery. I'm never sure.
I'm pretty sure that in this show, she was identified as the sister of a murder victim. And that the sister was a fashion model. And they have a moment where they find the body in a closet with high fashion. And then they cut to a fashion runway with her walking down it. And now the sister is being approached to being a model as well. And she wants to be like her sister. And unfortunately, turns into this scenario.
Yeah, she. It feels like she's at a strip club, though, when this goes down, or in the TV show, at least.
Right. Well, I think that's the bait and switch.
Which, again, is more commentary. You want to be a model? That yes. Usually is code for porn.
Right, yeah, the casting couch kind of thing. And I think that that's the metaphor of this movie, is that, and so often in chasing stardom, you're being lured into a world. It's certainly the moral view of this picture, is that you're being asked to degrade yourself if you want to be celebrated.
And I have to say, this rape scene, like, we talk, like, you gotta do this, like, this is kind of the movie to me. This is, when I watched this the first time, I'm like, okay, this is interesting, like, weird serial killer thing maybe going on. And then I got to this, and the ambiguity, the way it plays, like, okay, this is for a TV show, but then the guy apologizes, and you just don't know. Is she going along with the rape because she needs this role so bad? You see Rumi breaking into tears, like, she can't take it watching this. Like, it's a really hard scene to watch, but it is so effective and powerful, again, because of that ambiguity, I think. Like, yeah, this could be for a TV show, but it's also, like, the rape of this pop idol to make her a star.
This set really needs an intimacy coordinator, I just have to say.
Yes!
With that, all that's going on, I feel bad for Mima.
There's violations going on, it feels like.
Right, and yet at the same time, her trick is dissociation, right? She's yes. Okay with it because she just stares up in the lights and goes out of her body and is not there. You know, like, suddenly the scene is just over. And so for so much of the way she's getting through it is to just not be emotionally present. And unfortunately, that's going to lead to a pattern of behavior in the middle of this movie that means that she's never sure whether she's dreaming or what's happened to her reality from imagination. She tried to imagine when she was on that set, there's that awkward moment. They're filming the rape and they're graphic and you're like, oh my God, cut. And as they're setting up the cameras, you know, it's like a long, quiet moment. Everyone's just got to freeze there. That's when the rapist is apologizing. And she just tries to imagine that those lights above her are just the lights at a Cham concert, you know. And then I think we immediately move back into that singing and dancing stuff. Like, again, her comfort zone. What I'm doing is going to get me the love that I'm seeking. I think one thing I'm missing from this movie, and I know it's arguable whether it needs to be there or not. Again, the movie is about the absence of identity. So maybe it can't answer these questions. But I do think that we should have seen a little bit more of her pre-stardom. What made her drive to want to be a pop star? Was she seeking love, you know, and from whom? Why did she need this kind of validation? Maybe we don't need that because these days everyone expects it as a right.
Everyone wants to be a pop star these days.
Yeah. I mean, I think on some level, maybe, again, we understand what that is because every kid picks up a camera or a phone and, you know, puts themselves out there. I wanted to do that.
It is telling, though, like, you talk about her fish being her only friends. After this scene, like, which feels like the big break from being a pop idol, those fish are dead, or so we think, whether she's in her real room or not when she comes home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yes, is it because she forgot to feed them? Is it her own neglect? Is someone stalking her? Again, these are, you know, the gimmicks of the psychological film. You know, again, Bergman was such a practitioner of it. I do think Hitchcock, particularly in Vertigo, played a lot with this as well. And certainly we covered Brian De Palma earlier with Body Double. I'm definitely getting a lot of De Palma vibes.
Oh, yeah.
If this were a live-action movie, Brian De Palma would be making it.
It's sleazy enough for De Palma to make.
Yes, for sure. It's got to have that sleaze element for it to truly be De Palma.
Yeah, I was very shocked with anime. I can say that I've never seen animated girl parts before in a cartoon. I have avoided hentai my entire life. So this was shocking to me. I didn't expect this. I knew that Robert had said there was going to be some adult themes, but I did not expect it to go this far, especially during the nude photo shoot that comes after the rape scene. They really want to shove in your face the cartoon nudity. And while I'm talking about the cartoon, I do have to say I'm really enjoying the story here. The animation, I'm not an anime guy. You guys tell me. To me, this looks kind of shoddy, kind of choppy.
It feels very late 90s. Like, this is what I would have been watching. This was the conventional style.
Yeah, I think there's a house style to it. I don't think there's anything revolutionary about it. But I will say that Cone does have, like, it's kind of amazing. Maybe he didn't live long enough to do it. It's kind of amazing he never did work with live action, because I do feel like he really, sometimes in the way that he moves the camera, they feel like very cinematic devices that I'd not really seen in animation before. Usually, anime is flat. I think of it as being still and flat. And here, we're definitely seeing the perspective of a camera that is moving along and giving us Alfred Hitchcock kind of shots.
I noticed that too, and just the way it's edited, I don't feel like you get anime with sophisticated edits and cuts like this one does. It feels very special in that way.
It's put together in a very, like, sophisticated way, but the actual animation drawing quality, I don't feel is extraordinary.
It's pretty mid.
Yeah, it's minimal, and it's enough. It's not problematic, but I agree. I think that might have been part of my initial disappointment, was I had been told this was this amazing animated film, and the animation is not amazing. But what it's showing you, yes, perhaps shocking.
And I guess that's a question I would ask is, does this need to be anime? Robert Redden said when he picked this movie that he didn't think this story could be told live action. He thinks it uses the anime medium very well with its playing of what's real and what's not. I think this could be told in live action. I think you could definitely do a much better job with a live action Perfect Blue than a live action Ghost in the Shell. I think that, De Palma or somebody could take this and really make a live action version. I read up on why it's animated and things, but did it need to be animated? Is there anything about the anime format that fits this story or enhances this story specifically?
I mean, except maybe taking you off your guard and you're not expecting this kind of maturity in an animated feature.
Yeah. And again, the fluidity by which we can match cut, you know, so much of the editing and juxtaposition is, oh, I think I'm looking at one thing and then, oh, we're in an entirely different world. For example, like, you know, when there's a murdered body and then we see a cop siren, like the kind of red light we'd see on top of a cop car, but we pull back and it's a child riding a toy.
So masterful. It's so good.
Yeah. I mean, these things can and are done in, you know, very auteur cinematic movies, but it's not a style I typically see in a Hollywood B picture. I mean, I think it takes someone with a love of cinematography to pull this off in live action. But spoiler alert, Perfect Blue has been made as a live action film. We'll talk about it when this is over. So not only can it be done, it was done.
It has been done. Oh.
So then the murders start, and they really play with this. And yeah, this does feel very 90s. How many movies have I seen where there are murders? Am I the killer? Are there really deaths? Is this all in my head? It feels very of its time for that. But I mean, I'm saying that with 25 years of distance, it would have felt very current at the moment.
Yes. I did not think that it was a unique theme in the late 90s to have entertainers questioning the nature of reality, filmmaking versus real life, all of this stuff. I think there was something about the pre-millennial tension. There was something about the fact that we didn't know what was going to happen when we rounded the corner and entered that next decade. We had a lot of angst and we did a lot of self-reflection. And I think we had a lot of postmodern work because of that. And so it was just one of many. I will just say that my initial reaction was, oh, I've saw that movie every other week. Like, it did not feel thematically unique.
Thematically, I agree, not unique. But when you get to some of these murder scenes, especially the screenwriter, like just standing in the garage, like for an anime, you don't feel like people just stand around and like listen, because you could hear this pop music just kind of playing in the distance, and the way that elevator comes down and the boombox is in there. I've heard a lot of people describe this as a horror film, and it might be the way The Silence of the Lambs is. Is that a thriller or horror? It's somewhere in between, but a lot of people describe it as that just because of how, again, the sophistication of these kills, the way they're set up.
Yeah, I really like this just as, it may be the most scene, the most tangible scene in the entire thing. It's the only time where I feel like the movie just stops and works in this like moment here of like, yeah, this guy pulls into his parking garage, like there's a bloody sign where his car should be parked. he's hearing the Cham song. It's a Angel of Love, but he doesn't know where it's coming from. And when the elevator doors open, it's that boombox. There's something about the way that the song is so peppy but muffled that really makes this moment ominous. And then, man, what a smash cut.
It's just a cut!
To suddenly have, yeah, the doors open again on the fifth floor, and he's lying there dead with his eyes carved out. I think one challenge I have watching this movie is I don't really think of it as a whodunit, but we should. We should be asking, who is the killer? But I'm curious, particularly you, Arnie, since this is your first viewing, were you trying to figure out who in Mima's life was doing this to her?
The first time through, I was just wondering, are these deaths real?
Right.
Or is she possibly the killer? We did see that quite a lot in that period.
Mm-hmm.
I won't spoil any movies that are coming to mind where that's the big twist. We did review one with Secret Window, but I wasn't thinking of it as a whodunit necessarily, because we've also seen Mimania around so much that if there is a real killer, it's probably going to be him.
Right. And again, the book, there was no other killer. It wasn't a mystery. It was this crazy psycho fan. And he, by this point, had found a rival, the evil pop girl that was trying to ruin Mima's career. He had found her, kidnapped her, skinned her, was creating that suit.
I think, like Artie said, Mimania is too obvious. He's just too creepy looking. So I think the first time I watched this, I assumed it was Mima. Yeah, going into that disassociative state and killing those that are destroying her pop idol is kind of this, I don't know, self-hate or something going on, this conflict within her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the fact that he's named Mimamia and she's Mima, to me, says that it may just be a version of herself, right? The names are so close. And that Rumi, who is the ultimate, is like, feels like the inverse, like the palindrome inverse of Mima, Rumi. I don't know. I feel like all of this, again, that's the thing about psychodramas, is you could argue that all of this are just representations of an internal state, that we have a very insecure woman who is trying to navigate her identity at a crucial moment in her career where she's trying to become something new and something that she's not confident she can pull off. And again, so many people are making decisions for her, including that, yes, becoming a star means being raped on television. And it works. I mean, I want to point out that the show, I think it was doing well before, but I heard a lot of the Mima fans complaining it was boring. After she gets raped, she's now kind of the star, and I hear the ratings are going up. So there is something about the culture. Is it Japan? Is it human beings? That when something salacious like this is used, you took a pop star and you did that to them, we suddenly get invested in new ways and in larger numbers.
Yeah, as Tadakoro says, it worked for Jody What's-Her-Face.
Mm-hmm. And we get another kill here after too long. We see that Mima has decided to take racy photographs. Again, this was the subject of the book. Was that, I guess this is just a thing in Japanese culture, is that if you really want to shock people, you put out these photo books. It wasn't totally uncommon for some, usually female artists, to go and, yeah, put out a collection of tasteful. You want to straddle that line between, you don't want it to be pornographic. You don't want to be seen as a sex worker, but you want to be able to, yeah, show all of yourself and show your maturity and your confidence. And this was what the pop star Mima was trying to do in the book, was create a photo book that would come out with the new single that would really energize sales of her songs, because new fans would come to it. And here, it's a montage, like so much of this. It's hard to know exactly what we're seeing, but I get the impression that this is where she's starting to really regret choices. She might have enjoyed the moment of the man taking the photographs. It's just her kind of like brushing her teeth, going about her day. You know, nothing about the photographs are, you know, overtly staged as anything, you know, amazing. But she is full frontal naked. And she does imagine guys on the subway just casually reading. You know, it's not uncommon a sight to have grown men reading and looking at pornographic material right there in the public subway. And I think that is what's starting to really bother Mima, is that private moment is now being consumed in such a mass market way.
And we've seen this character show up before, but she shows up again. I call her Pop Mima, is the pop idol version of herself that she'll see in reflections. And she's like, no, you've gone too far. You're going back to Cham. Like, no one wants you to act like this is the critical self, I guess. And to me, especially the first time I watched this, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is that internal dialogue going on. Did I make the wrong choice doing this?
Right. Yeah, I call it the Cham Phantom, but yes, when she's in the girl group and wearing the girly dress, yes, and everyone can agree she's cute and lovable. Again, even Mom called to say, isn't singing what you're best at? Like, isn't this what you should be? Who she was is taunting who she's transforming into. And I got to ask, are we to think that it's entirely in her mind, or is this in some way Rumi? You know, we will see that ultimately, in the end, Rumi is this figure. Is she somehow doing this?
I think this is in Mima's head. I think Rumi doesn't really have an overt influence on Mima until the end. We're going to find out, though, Rumi is puppeting Mimania because she's sending him letters or emails, one or the other, I'm not sure which, saying, I'm the real Mima. And that's a fake Mima who's out there hurting my name. And that's what's motivating Mimania to kill.
Yeah. But he also imagines that Phantom, like, hugging him as he's typing away. Like, she has an online diary that he's writing. So you have this man writing this diary of his pop idol that she has nothing, no say in, and putting all these pictures to support his version of her. But now, yes, he's being told by the real killer, I suppose, that he should take out. We know that he is the one taking out the screenwriter that wrote that rape scene, the photographer that took those pictures. He's the one that faxed traitor, traitor, traitor. Maybe.
After Rumi supplied the phone number, maybe.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to know. Again, he sort of just symbolically represents the disdainful fan, the fan that is not cool with watching their idol become something new.
And it's a little bit odd when we actually see one of the murders. The photographer orders a pizza and the pizza delivery person drops it on the ground. I'm like, okay, well, this is the killer. But I couldn't quite tell. And again, the animation makes it indistinct. That pizza delivery person could have been Mima, or I guess it is Mimania, but it's really hard to tell from that shot.
Or is it Rumi? Like, those clothes are going to end up in Mima's closet. I don't think Mimania has access to her room. I think that's Rumi's doing. So did she take the bloody clothes and from herself? Or, yeah, did she get the other guy to kill him and then take the clothes?
Right. I think that if you want the most literal, like, I can follow this storyline, then that's the way you have to go, right? But I kind of like that this movie lives in the nebulous, in the psychological, where you don't really know. It's not about figuring out who's behind it all. It's really just feeling the fear of this character. That's where I'm at. I'm identifying with how paranoid and how unfair it is to have a life where so many people have opinions about a you that you had no participation in.
Yeah, that's what I appreciate about this film, is that it captures that emotion of not being in control of your life. Is it literal? Is it not? That ultimately doesn't matter. That sneak peek to the end of this film, I don't care that there's a killer. Like, I didn't even need that.
Right, exactly. That's kind of where I'm at. It actually was a surprise. And certainly I had forgotten everything about this movie, quite honestly. We get to the wrap up. Of course, they first got to solve Double Bind. The show is, I guess, a mini-series. It's coming to an end. And the last episode is the reveal that, yes, it seems like Mima is now the star. That she didn't kill her sister, but had a, you know, DID diagnosis in her dissociative state. She had an alternate identity that killed her sister. And so, yes, we are to understand that there are two Mimas. And when the last shot of the show is her looking into the reflective glass of an interrogation room, we're set up for the idea that there are going to be two Mimas in this climax as well.
And they play with that a little bit too, because you've got Mima there saying she's an actress, but that's in her head when her character is saying, I'm a supermodel. and the parallels there going on between what's happening in Mima's life with the murders and what's happening on the show where she's a killer, leading to more of the questions of, is Mima really committing the murders?
Yeah, I think this really gets manic in the last act with all these cuts of like, take two and you'll get a scene, and then take three and then like she wakes up and the room's like a little bit different, and like it, you really like lose any sense of reality, which is probably the point. Like, this woman doesn't have any sense of reality in this crazy entertainment world, and yeah, you just keep cutting to different scenes and then reenacting them, and they're a little different every time.
Yeah, it's capturing the madness, the paranoia, the mania quite well. But yes, I think it does decide to opt for, you know, I don't know if this is traditional Hollywood, but it feels like a giallo ending, right? Like, we got to give you a killer. We've got to explain this. We first have the long-haired stringy guy, and it seems like he's the one that's the problem. Like, he appears at the studio after everyone has left for the rap party and takes her to the set, the very place where she filmed her rape. He is now going to rape her, and she fights back. Does she kill him?
I don't think so.
Yeah, she hits him with a hammer and he falls down, but there's no blood leaking out. There's a rape scene in this. They can show blood, so it's not like it's a ratings thing. So it has to be a deliberate choice to not show that blood.
Right. But he is very dead. We will see that when Rumi comes to comfort her, she's like, why haven't you come to the car? We're waiting to go to the rap party. You know, she drives her away and the girl starts dissociating. When she wants to talk to her manager, ring, 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 we cut and we see that Rumi very much is killed in that parking lot. The manager, right next to him, is this Mimania.
Yeah, so I take it Rumi did this.
Yeah, I think Rumi finished off Mimania and moved the body to put next to the manager.
Mm-hmm, right. But this is a nice, trippy moment where, yes, Mima finally snaps out of it, wakes up. Maybe she was drugged. Who knows? There's no evidence of that. But it seems like she had really dissociated. And now she's back in her room, Mima's room, except things aren't quite right. The fish are alive again.
That Cham poster's back up.
Yeah, she tore down that poster and it's there. She looks out the window and there's a train going by. That's not my view. I'm in my room, but it's not quite right, is the feeling that this movie's been giving us this whole time. And it's where she realizes that, yes, Rumi's not just my assistant. She's my super fan. She's been trying to turn me into, yes, some kind of idol to fulfill the dreams that she didn't finish. And now she's going to put on the red dress, ill-fitting as it is, and give us a traditional, I think, of Dress to Kill kind of ending.
Yeah, I do love, like, when they're chasing each other around, you'll see the reflection of Rumi, like, struggling to try to keep up, and then the imaginary version of Mima, like, just kind of floating along in that baby doll dress.
Yeah, I do love that image. I mean, so much of the imagery in this. Again, it's not that the animation is anything special, but just that image of the Cham Phantom hopping along the streetlights, you know? Like,
yeah.
There's something about a killer that's hopping after you that just is so perfectly Japanese.
Yeah, this is where it really goes surreal with its imagery, and where I do feel animation works a little bit better, because if this were live action and we saw the Rumi Mima transformation, sometimes we were seeing Rumi, sometimes we were seeing Mima, it might play weirder in live action. It works here, and the floating from lamppost to lamppost during this chase, but I'm expecting Mima to be victorious. I'm expecting this to end with Rumi's death. And so when Rumi, by her own volition, goes and bends over to pick something up and impales herself on glass, I'm like, okay, well, she's dead. But they're going to have yet another twist on this.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's the what they're getting at here. I mean, I think this movie has had, throughout its runtime, this very disdainful idea about pop stardom, right? Like, I sense it's really, it judges you harshly if you feel like that's something that's worth pursuing. And the fact that this is an older woman who's gained some weight and is still trying to put on the baby doll dress and still trying to do it, that's part of why it's so nightmarish, why she's so ghoulish, is that she looks like this bloated version of Mima running around. And when she loses the ice pick, she's going to try to kill her with an umbrella. I love that too. Like, I mean, I imagine those things do hurt, but again, the absurdity of that.
Yeah, she's in full-blown mania at this point. Like, this is no sense of sanity left with Rumi.
Yes. It is the right choice for Mima to leave behind this pop world is what I'm getting from this. It's correct to transform away, to get away, because otherwise you end up looking like Rumi. Too old, sad, deranged, and thinking you're in the spotlight when you're in the headlights of a truck screeching right at you. And yes, this would have been easily one way to end it all, is you kill the killer, right? And now it's all over. But I think most 95% of the serial killer movies I've seen, that's how it would go out. This movie, I think, shows finally who Mima is by the fact that she's willing to save a deranged assistant that wanted to kill her minutes ago. She has compassion. She has heart.
She's going to visit her at the mental hospital. I'm assuming her mental prison.
Bring her flowers. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm bringing her flowers. You can tell Rumi thinks, oh, I'm a pop star still, like the way she's holding those flowers.
Yeah, there's a caring there. And I guess it stems from the fact that at one point, this was her assistant. This was someone that really wanted to guide her career and cared a lot about Mima the pop star. In some ways, this is a way of Mima protecting that part of herself by letting Rumi remain a deranged, obese pop star in an asylum.
And it's you started with those words, who am I? And it ends with, I'm real. Like, this whole journey has somehow helped her realize who she is, apparently. She's figured out.
It's a little easy.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a little easy. We don't quite know what that means. I mean, she's obviously wearing sunglasses so that people don't recognize her. That signals to me that she has transitioned to become a big actress, right? The nurses are gossiping about her as she's walking back to her car. I don't think I was prepared, but, you know, with Japanese anime, tonal shifts are very, very common. But it's just suddenly so peppy. They're like, I know who I am. And like suddenly we're like happy. Like, this is an upbeat ending.
Well, I kind of took that as, I don't know, sarcasm. Like, she thinks she knows who she is, but it's in this realm of entertainment where no one really knows who they are.
I didn't take it as ironic. I really took it to mean that we should leave feeling that Mima is going to be okay.
Yeah, I took it the same way you did, Stuart. I thought this was just a happy ending.
It's not that kind of movie, so I couldn't read it that way.
Well, but sometimes I think that, like, that could be, like, the way to make people feel better about the queasy ambiguities they've been, you know, drowning in for the last 70 minutes. So everything's okay now. Don't worry. Play the pop song. Roll credits. Almost too lighthearted of an ending. I would have preferred something a little bit more ominous. Yeah, maybe it reads that way by being so chipper.
And as we get to the end here, like, I'm still trying to figure out this title, Perfect Blue.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think of blue. She does a lot of blue things in here. Rape scene, nudity. Like, I don't know if it's that. If it's depression, you have the blues. I don't know if it's some Japanese specific meaning for blue. I still struggle to figure out what Perfect Blue actually means. Why is it called this?
Yeah. Again, the book was the Total Metamorphosis. They renamed it Perfect Blue, Total Metamorphosis. The what I actually land on is, like, when she's finally feeling better about herself, we have our first clear blue sky. She never says the words, it's a perfect blue sky, but that's kind of how I experience it. So much of this animation has been fractured, and we haven't enjoyed the landscape. It's been ominous, harsh, you know, it's filled with little pictures of herself taunting herself. To have an open blue sky is in some ways to be free of the curse of celebrity. Maybe. I don't know. It is an ambiguous title, not unlike Clockwork Orange. It doesn't mean a whole lot.
Yeah, I was really hoping that the book would provide more insight into that title.
That wasn't even the name of the book originally.
Yeah. Perfect Blue. I mean, you could call it pretension. Yes, there's no, as far as I can tell, there was nothing in the book, nothing in the movie that ever referenced, used those words. But we do end on a blue sky. So that's, I guess, a perfect blue sky.
But is it a perfect blue movie? Jacob, Stuart, do you recommend Perfect Blue? Jacob.
First of all, I just want to say, like, this is the wrong format to discuss this film. This is not a plot-driven film, and we're usually a plot-driven podcast, and it's so hard to get across, like, what this film does to me, because it's the visuals. It's those cuts we've talked about, those edits. Stuart, you talk about that, hearing the police siren, and then you see it, and then it pulls back, and it's a kid's toy, and it's like, wow, like, there's so many moments, like, just edits and cuts in this film where I'm just like, wow, what an amazing, like, smash cut or smash edit, you know, whatever, all the different kind of editing skills, they're here, and that's what's really impressive, the way that it jumps around to create that ambiguity, and, yeah, this ending, I don't need it wrapped up, because this is a film about an emotion, about a state of mind, and I think when it focuses on that, that is when it really works. The fact that it's got to be the serial killer thing that they're going to resolve, like some people earlier in the film say, oh, the Japanese TV always does this, and it's so boring, and like, yeah, the Americans have kind of done this a lot too, and I expect it, but there's so much more to appreciate with this, with just, yeah, always trying to figure out what's going on, what's real, what's in Mima's head, and just that confusion of, like, yeah, she's technically an adult, but in your early 20s, like, you're still figuring out the world, especially if you're in entertainment. Like, that is a crazy, crazy world. So I think, yeah, you should watch this one because of the visuals. And I don't know enough about movie making to know if this kind of stuff could be done in a traditional film. I expect it to be a lot harder to come up with in live action with these kind of edits and stuff. But that's what's really impressive to me with the ambiguity it creates and just the emotion and the mindset that you get into watching this film. It's strong recommend. Check it out.
Stuart.
I'm happy and pleased to see that this movie's reputation has survived. When I saw it, I just want to point out I was consuming a lot of anime. It was just one of many things that I saw. I remember having generally positive feelings, but not really lasting. I think it's always a gift when you're able to go back and look at something that maybe you dismissed too quickly. I think that there are more layers here than I was willing to see. And I think because we now live in an age where so many people can both experience their life as a super world celebrity and as somebody that rides a bike to their miserable small house and can barely pay for milk. I mean, I do think it's just a more relatable concept right now. Who are we as a culture? This is what we become. And I do think that there's something prophetic about Perfect Blue and what it saw as a transformation from, yes, just wanting to be silly entertainment and wanting to be taken seriously and show more adult themes. I do think it's an imperfect movie. I will say that, yeah, the stuff with the serial killer, I'm kind of like in Jacob's camp. I don't know that I even needed that to be resolved. And I certainly don't know that I needed to be resolved in this way. It just ended up feeling like a giallo. It just ended up feeling like a very melodramatic, highly stylized serial killer movie from the 1970s, which is fun. You know, I think, again, let Dario Argento make it, let Brian De Palma make it. I can appreciate it as that kind of movie. I don't know that I celebrate it as the classic that I feel like sometimes I'm hearing about the movie now, but I do like it. And I do think that Jacob's right. It's not about describing what happens. It's really not about who the killer is. It's about allowing yourself to drift into this current, this stream, this rushing water of celebrity and feel the rush of what it is to lose yourself, both the terror and the joy of losing yourself in pop culture. I think that this movie captures that quite well. There were a lot of movies in the late 90s that were consumed with reality and identity, but this one, by being in the anime format, is something special, and I do think you should see it.
3 for 3, and I want to thank Robert for picking this movie that I never would have watched any other way. Again, I'm not an anime guy.
You're not even an animation guy, I feel like, on some of the reviews I've heard. So this is a surprise.
Yeah, and like I wasn't on the Princess Mononoke review, but I watched that movie, and I was kind of mild on it. I just, again, I'm not an animation guy. And so to come into another anime film, I was a little hesitant. I had my guard up. I wasn't sure what I was in for. And what I got was a surprisingly complex character study that does rely on a lot of tropes from the time, but does it in a novel way that does predate things that I love, like Requiem for a Dream. I really liked the way it played with the concept of reality. I liked the arc that Mima goes through. But unlike you guys, I actually also really enjoyed the murder mystery part. It gave it a thrust that I felt was kind of missing early on the first time I watched it. It kind of feels like Mima is just shambling until we really start getting some of the threats and the escalation of the danger. I like this as a murder story. I like it as, yeah, an anime Silence of the Lambs type film. And yes, when it turns out to be the assistant, I definitely felt like Shades of Selena. It would have really felt that way at the time because Selena would have only been killed like 3 years before this came out, 2 years.
I think it was an influence, Arnie. I don't think you're off on that. I mean, I think that had to be on his mind in reshaping the book material.
Rumi even kind of looks like Selena's assistant who killed her. Or yeah. At least the way she's portrayed in the Selena movie with J-Lo.
I didn't know about Selena until she was dead. So to me, her murder by the president of her own fan club is a major part of her identity. It would make all the sense in the world that that's how Khan also saw that story.
So yeah, it is a solid recommend for this film. I really enjoyed it, and it opens my mind to what anime can be. It doesn't all have to be the very first frames of this movie with the Power Rangers knockoff guys.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's true, that this is an anime unlike one that you're commonly going to pick up. And maybe didn't even need to be in that format, but chose to be and is better for it. Certainly when you watch the 2002 live action movie that I was able to only find on YouTube in a dub that did not have English subtitles. So I had to hold my phone up and have the translator on to try and read what they were saying.
I've done that.
As it was playing out. But I want to be clear. I had read a lot of bad reviews before I found this thing. And people were saying, oh, it's no good. They got it all wrong. You really need to understand that Satoshi Kon made his own story from elements of the book. This is an adaptation of the book.
So you're saying this is, yeah, closer to that novel you read?
If you like Perfect Blue, the anime, there's almost nothing left of it in this live action. It was given to a director of softcore, and for some reason, he decided to lean away from that. There are long moments where it's all about the killer aroused by the fact that a pop star has moved into his neighborhood. He runs a convenience store, and she's always dropping in, buying things while she's trying to record music, and he's getting aroused by that. But there are just long moments where people sit and listen to musical recordings and nothing happens. It's really minimalist and not at all like the telling of this movie, where I feel like there are layers and layers upon the visuals. Here, you can be watching a scene for 4 minutes and nothing has changed, not even the expression on a person's face. I don't recommend it, even though I can't fully say that I saw it. Again, not knowing all the translations weren't coming through, I gotta say that I definitely prefer Khan's vision than either book or this pathetic live-action version. Should also be said that the author, in trying to exploit this, did write, I guess you could call it a sequel. It's a short story collection of other fans tormenting their pop idols.
This is a Japanese thing. They did a similar thing with Your Name, where I read, here's like just other scenes that happened off screen.
Yeah, right. These are just new characters that find themselves in situations of being bound, tied, and tortured. And if that's your thing, no judgment, but it's not my Perfect Blue. I wasn't into it, and I didn't read much of it. A few pages, and I realized Perfect Blue, Awakened from a Dream, was not what I wanted to see continue. It was starting to feel like the exploitive entertainment that Satoshi Kon was actually criticizing. But that's it for anime for a while, but not it for romantic films, if that's what we're calling this. February, it's Valentine's Day. We always like to make something a little bit for lovers. And we're going back to the classics, back to what's been called one of the greatest movies of all time. We covered Gone with the Wind a year ago. Now we're going to cover its twin, Casablanca. Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, here's looking at you, kid, so many years later.
I have to say, when I finally watched that movie, it unlocked so many inside jokes on Looney Tunes. I can't believe how influential this black and white romance was on, like, just pop culture in general.
Mm. It's true. I did get to see it in theaters for my first experience back when I was a teenager, and I have a lifelong relationship with it. I love it. I always look forward. It's been a while since I've watched Casablanca, and I hope if you've never seen it, if you think you know what it's going to be, give yourself to it. Join us next February. It's our patron pick for Valentine's Day.
And thank you again to Robert Redden for picking this film. I hope that it was a good birthday gift to yourself, and I really appreciate the support for the show. And from all of us to everyone listening who is a supporter of our show, thank you for being a supporter. The patron exclusive podcasts run the gamut. Next month, we're doing a movie that I dare say nobody hasn't heard of. And this month, we did something a little bit less known. I mean, I feel like we do that all the time. We'll do High Tension, a foreign film, Hot Tension, and then Gone with the Wind and some Kubrick films. So thank you for being a supporter during the months we cover popular movies and going with us when we cover the ones that are a little bit more obscure.
Yeah, it's a fun thing that I love that. I love we make room for franchises, and I love that we can also find room to include one-offs and just crazy experiences that, yeah, I don't know what a sequel to this would even be. Glad they didn't make it.
And Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me, and I'll get you next time, Powertron.
Am I alive? Is this really happening? Huh? Maybe that truck hit me, and all this has been a dream. I just can't make out the difference anymore.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Well done, guys. Thanks for all the work and good times.
And a special thank you to Robert Redden for his amazing support of our show, and for picking Perfect Blue for our hosts to review.
Cheers, everyone!
Cheers!
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Ngonza Media Incorporated.
Oh, God. I don't know anything about myself anymore.
Ngonza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Excuse me, are you currently represented by an agent?
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
But it was... I mean, a crime was committed.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Ngonza Media Incorporated.
Excuse me, who are you?
Now Playing is a Ngonza Media production, copyright 2025, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Ngonza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Bye-bye! Ah!